Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Busy, busy program today. Joining us in studio, Jeff Thiemann, who is the new president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Health Systems. He's, like I said, he's new to his position, so let's find out about his background, his vision for the organization, and after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, Dave Moody, former WDEV employee and now an announcer for the Motor Racing Network. Dave will join us as part of our 85th year anniversary, WDEV's 85th year anniversary celebration, where we interview those that have made WDEV so popular and beloved in Vermont. But first, a couple of things struck me in the news this morning, and if you got your opinions, we'll open up the phone lines for a little while here. The first thing that struck me was Governor Shumlin said he's going to appoint the replacement for retiring Justice Dooley. John Dooley is retiring in March, and Governor Shumlin will be gone in March, and yet he said he's going to appoint the replacement for retiring Judge Dooley, even though Shumlin will be a lame duck. His successor will likely have been elected by that time, and Justice Dooley doesn't leave his position until March, well after Governor Shumlin has left his office. So the question I have this morning, the governor's legal counsel says he can do this, but should he do it? Also, under the category, there he goes again, Howard Dean is suggesting that Donald Trump may be on cocaine. So the question I have on that, is this fair game? After all, he did sniffle during the debate. Or is this sort of going over the top? And Randy Brock has accused David Zuckerman of being insensitive to race. Is he? And if we get some time, I want to do an update to the Wells Fargo debacle. The president and CEO is giving up some money. Is that still enough for what they did? 5,300 people lost their jobs, but no senior level employees lost their job. One is retiring a little bit early, but nobody lost their job. So is the clawback, that they call it, the clawback of some of the money that was earned during this time, is it enough, or should people at the top go? So Governor Shumlin said yesterday that he will appoint the next Supreme Court justice, even though he is a lame duck, the governor's a lame duck. It will likely happen after the November election, where there'll be a new governor, a new and recognized governor. Hasn't taken office yet, but still there is a new governor that will be taking over the budget process, that will start taking over the reins of government, although they don't take officially office until January, and the fact that Justice Dooley retires in March. The governor says he has the legal right to do this and has checked. But the question is, if he does have the legal right and he says he can do it, the question is, should he? Now, spokesman for Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott questions the legality of Shumlin replacing Dooley. She said Shumlin's push to name a successor is a sign that the governor believes Scott will defeat the Democratic nominee, Sue Minter. And clearly he thinks Phil's going to win. But here's where she says, obviously, there are some questions. She questioned when Shumlin would make the nomination, whether the current Senate or the one elected in November would confirm the nomination. And here's a quote. If Dooley is stepping down after Shumlin leaves office, how is it legal for him to nominate someone to fill a vacancy that doesn't yet exist? And how can it be reviewed by a Senate that hasn't yet been elected? So the question is, from Shumlin's legal counsel, they say he can. But should the governor appoint the replacement that's clearly going to be under the new governor coming in? And I don't, it doesn't matter whether it's Sue Minter or Phil Scott. It's going to be under a new governor. Now, here's how it works. There's a judicial nominating committee. They collect names of people who are interested in being a Supreme Court justice. They review the names. They make some recommendations to the governor. Usually that takes a little bit of time. So let's say that they get the names, they get things done in December. One of the things that the governor can do then would be appoint in December. But remember, the election is in November, so there will be a new Senate, a new governor. And by the way, there isn't a vacancy until March. So what's your opinion here? Do you think the governor should? Look, to me, this is why Governor Shumlin is unpopular with Vermonters. Because you can do something, or possibly can do something, I don't know the legality of this, doesn't necessarily mean that you should do something. And this is where the governor gets into problems all the time with Vermonters. Because you can make a land deal with a disadvantaged neighbor, that doesn't mean you should make the land deal. Just because you can stay mum on what your plans are for single payer until after the election doesn't mean that you should do that. Hiding limo cost in a trip to Paris just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And here's the problem the governor has with Vermonters. Just because you can do something, or possibly can do something, doesn't mean that you do it. You know, the fairer thing for the governor to do would be allow the next governor to appoint the Supreme Court justice and the next Senate to confirm it. So if you've got an opinion, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Don in Morrisville. Don, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I think you hit the nail on the head, and this is exactly why Shumlin is always in trouble with the citizens of the state. But I think you also know as well as I do that if he makes this appointment, it's going to go to the Supreme Court of the U.S. And it'll probably delay anybody actually taking that seat for some time. So what does he really think he's gaining? That, to me, is the real question. I think this man should have been out of office years ago, but then again, he shouldn't have been here in the first place. But I can't understand mentality of doing something like this, because I think he certainly realizes it's going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Don, thank you for your phone call. I do think that from his perspective, what he wants to do is make sure he gets in somebody that's philosophically aligned with him before a new governor comes in. Well, you know, why not? Let's give an example. Sue Minter may win this election. Why not give her the opportunity to put a Supreme Court justice in there instead of himself? Let's go to Michael in Morrisville. Michael, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I have two comments. First, on Governor Shumlin, this is just purely sour grapes. He has no legacy worth anything, and he's just sticking it in the eye of everybody. He's saying, I can do it, so I'm going to do it. And that's why he's going to appoint Dooley's successor in advance.
Do you think it's right, Michael?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. And my second comment has to do with our ex-governor,
Howard
Dr. Dean.
His
comment about he thinks Donald Trump was using cocaine. Come on. The man, not only was he a public figure and still is, he's a doctor, and he's going to diagnose this from a TV picture? Please.
Thank you, Michael.
That's an embarrassment. Okay.
Thank you, Michael, for your phone call. What Governor Dean had said in a tweet, notice Trump sniffling all the time. Coke user? Question mark. And then yesterday on television, he sort of doubled down on his cocaine comment. He says, well, you can't make a diagnosis over the television, he said. I would never do that. But he has some interesting that is actually a signature of people who use cocaine. I'm not suggesting that Trump does, but he said, when he was asked specifically, well, are you suggesting it actually in a tweet, the commentator asked, no, I'm suggesting we think about it, Dean said. Then he rattled off a list of symptoms he said Trump shared with cocaine users, ranging from all these sort of things that Dean had talked about. And, you know, it just sort of perpetuates this sort of thing. We're talking about two things today. Governor Shumlin says he can appoint a new Supreme Court justice, even though he's going to be a lame duck. A new governor will have already been elected, and Justice Dooley doesn't retire until March. Says he's going to appoint Dooley's successor, or should it wait? And then Dean doubles down on the Trump cocaine comment. Good article by Paul Hines on this in 7 days. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Dr. Dean's a political hack, and he can't control himself. Look at his history. Remember when he was running for president, and he did that crazy scream?
Mm-hmm.
And now he's doing this today. I just can't get over it.
You know, one of the things that Fred, you raise a good point here, but one of the things that happens with pundits, and maybe it even happens with myself, is that, you know, you elevate your rhetoric to get noticed, and that's the cycle of the 24-hour news cycle out there, that you elevate your rhetoric to get noticed. That may be what he's doing out there in order to get noticed, but also,
That's what political hacks do, right?
Yeah, I mean
that's my point. He's a political hack. He's screaming, he's yelling, he's carrying on.
But we get away. Isn't that what we expect from our political analysts today? I don't know. It seems kind of.
I listen to you. You know, I listen to you every day, and I don't consider you a political hack.
Mm-hmm.
You're not screaming and yelling. Of course, he doesn't have a radio show. So you have to exhibit control.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't exhibit control, then you're going to lose your audience. You know that.
Yeah. So what do you think about Governor Shumlin?
My problem is with Shumlin is he's a Democrat, and I think the Democrats have ruined and will ruin the state of New York. I mean, the only Republican I like was when I was a kid. And he was a senator, and I keep forgetting his name. He was famous. What was his name back 30, 40 years ago? He was a senator from New York. Can't remember his name.
Well, there was Buckley, and then there was Senator Buckley. There was Senator Kennedy.
This was during the Vietnam War. He was a Republican. He was famous.
Hmm.
Can't remember? He was a famous Republican.
Yeah, I can't. I can't remember, Fred.
Yeah.
Hey, Fred. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Bart in Milton. Bart, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. So as far as Shumlin goes, it may not be right, but he has the right. I think the argument against him appointing a Supreme Court justice in the lame duck session is the same horrible argument that's being made against Obama's nomination, which, you know, sort of unprecedented that a president with 1 year left to go on his term has refused to vote on Supreme Court justice, citing the lame duck session. So I think, you know,
someone has the right.
He's still governor until January, whatever. But, and if he wants to do that, he can do that.
Bart, let me just follow up on that a little bit. But in the U.S. Supreme Court instance, there is a vacancy. There is no vacancy here until March. And after January, there'll be a new governor. Actually, after November, there'll be a governor-elect. So there are differences here. I just wanted to recognize those differences.
Oh, yeah, I didn't understand that. So the vacancy won't happen until after the new governor is in place?
That's right.
Oh, then you can't do that.
Thanks, Bart, for your phone call. Bill from Barry. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Oh, my goodness. The thing about appointing, this is going to be, I've already heard just this morning from you and the customers, that this is going to be the most unpopular appointment that has ever been made, it seems like. And if I was the person being appointed, I would not accept it, because this is going to be kind of hard on the person who becomes that justice appointed this way. So I don't think you would get the best person for the position. So from the point of view of a citizen, I don't like the idea. It may be legal, but if it's so unpopular that this justice, we're not going to get the best person for the job.
You know, Bill, thank you for your phone call. You raise a really interesting point, is that this person will be controversial if that person is appointed by this governor, and what sort of impact will that person have, and what sort of scrutiny will that person come under? Coming up, Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We'll talk to him about his vision and his background, because he's new to the position. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Tom, you know, part of the thing that I do here is try to guess the bumper music. I guessed what you were going to be coming in on. It's going to be interesting. I'm starting to read your mind here, pal. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program and to our WDEV studios, Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you so much for having me on.
So let's ask the first obvious question. What does the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems do?
Sure. So we are the trade group representing the interests of hospitals across Vermont. And that also means that we're interested in making sure that there's a healthcare system here in the state that's available and accessible to everyone who needs healthcare where they need it and when they need it. So we work to improve the healthcare system, make sure hospitals are well represented in the state house, and continually listen to various constituencies about how to make sure that we have a good healthcare system for everyone here in the state.
So you're relatively new to the position. Tell us about yourself and why Vermont was attractive to you.
Sure. So I've been living in Washington, D.C. for the last 15 years, where I worked for the association that represents Catholic hospitals nationally. And D.C. can be both an actual and metaphorical swamp. And I was tired of the heat and tired of the sort of a stalemate politics that can go on there. And when this opportunity presented itself, I saw a state where there's a very different spirit of collaboration and enterprise and working together to solve problems. And then when I came up here to interview, I found a beautiful place where I wanted to live. So it was really just an opportunity that I couldn't turn down, and I'm really thrilled to be here.
How'd you get into healthcare?
Yeah, that's a good question. In college, I actually had an internship with a newsletter publisher in Denver, where I'm born and raised, and basically sort of fell into it from there. It was an internship that turned into a consulting kind of communications position, and then I worked in journalism a little bit in healthcare, and then into association work. So I've been in it my entire career.
What do you see as your most significant challenge for your association?
You know, I think healthcare is going through a lot of change right now, as it always is. But we're, you know, moving or at least trying to move, and many of our hospitals are already very much engaged in this work, of creating a system where we reward value instead of volume in terms of the care that people receive, where we try to focus on not just treating an acute illness, but actually work on addressing community needs that create a healthier space for people to live in and to work in, and therefore people stay healthier. And we need to move to a healthcare system that actually incentivizes that kind of behavior, and so that we're actually creating healthier communities and not just treating people once they're really sick.
I'll come back to that in a minute.
Sure.
When I talk about all payer, but yeah. What are some of the opportunities? We just discussed the challenge. What are some of the opportunities? The same thing?
Yeah, well, I think there's some opportunities in community partnerships. That, you know, we just had our association annual meeting in Manchester last week, and one of the sessions was about some innovative and terrific work going on in Rutland, where the hospital has partnered with the mayor's office, police, and community service organizations to address the opioid addiction problem. And through their partnership and some of the work that they've been doing down there, they've actually not only reduced actual opioid use, but all of the associated problems, home burglaries, street crimes, a whole host of things that have improved because they're getting everyone together at the table to solve a problem that then also reduces emergency room visits and just, you know, really creates sort of, again, a healthier place for people to be.
One of the things that we're going to be doing until the legislative session starts is about weekly talking about healthcare and healthcare issues. Obviously, we've had some people in here. Al Gobay was in here last mm-hmm. week. The week before was Senator Tim Ash, and you this week. But there is an issue that's out there that is I think probably an announcement at some point. The state is involved in seeking a federal waiver for an all-payer model reimbursement. It sort of changes the stuff. Our audience has been – we've been trying to talk about that all-payer model and what it does. This is a significant change. Do you see it as a benefit to hospitals, or will it be a traumatic, maybe even tumultuous time?
Yes. So I think it's really all of the above. It is both an opportunity and a challenge. As I said in my earlier remarks, the all-payer model really tries to move us to a place where we manage the health of a population, where we're not only treating illness once it happens, but trying to make sure people receive the care and preventive primary care that they need so they don't get sick in the first place. That really does require a transformation and a different way of thinking about how we both finance and deliver health care in Vermont. And so I think there's some details that we still don't know. And once those details start to surface and we can examine them and figure out, you know, the extent to which they're good for hospitals and where there are problems, we'll know more to answer your question. But I think overall, we support in concept the notion of moving to a pay-for-performance kind of system and one that also rewards working with community partners to address sort of the social problems that can create not the healthiest places.
What happens, for example, let's say this goes in and let's say it does everything that it says that it's going to do, that it's going to manage the overall health of the population in a way, and the reimbursement system is towards that, managing the overall health of the population. What happens to hospitals?
Oh, I think, you know, hospitals obviously continue to exist very much to serve their communities as they do now, but also to do more. So a lot of times what we think of as a hospital is a place where they actually house patients, right? So I think the new way to think of it is a lot of what happens outside the walls of the hospital. So whether that's the opioid example that I provided or a hospital working with construction companies to create safe bike paths in town so that people have a way to walk and bike and they stay healthier that way, to work on anti-smoking initiatives, all kinds of things where the hospital can play a role in promoting the health of the community. And I think they do a lot of that work now, but under this new model would do even more of it to address what we call the social determinants of health, things like your economic situation, your social environment, the extent to which you have healthy food that you can choose from to eat. So all of those things can again, help create safer, healthier places for us to live and work, and hospitals would be integrally involved in that.
I would imagine it's a challenge to represent the needs of, in this state, for example, UVM Medical Center
and Grace Cottage all at the same time. One's a huge, huge medical center. One's a small hospital. How do you do that?
Yeah, so I think the way you do that speaks to one of the things I've been most impressed with about Vermont, and that's through transparency and dialogue. So I came up here and was immediately taken just so surprised pleasantly by the sort of collaborative spirit that exists up here and the transparent way that work gets done, especially around healthcare. You go to a Green Mountain Care Board meeting and see that the public and the healthcare advocate can sit there and ask questions of the board and of hospital leaders. That's truly unprecedented and unparalleled in this country. It really is. And so I think the answer to your question about competing interests among our members is to keep them at the table. Promote dialogue and understanding, and when there's a conflict, to try to work through it together. That seems to be the spirit of Vermont.
What are your goals for the association?
I want it to continue to be a strong, leading healthcare voice in the state, to provide information and resources not only to our members, but also to other audiences and the general public. And I think, you know, to the point of this interview and the work you're doing to bring in other healthcare folks is to explain things that are hard to understand. And I think if we're not doing that work, then it might not get effectively done. And so I think that's one of the roles I hope to promote for the association.
We're speaking with Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. If you have a question or a comment about healthcare or hospitals or health systems, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. How are you getting yourself up to speed about the state, about the issues? What's the process that you go through?
Yeah, so basically I'm just trying to meet with everyone I can from other groups, from various government offices, and also spending a lot of time with my board, which is made up of the hospital presidents. To learn from there, what are the issues on the ground? How can we be helpful? What do you want the association to do? And so a lot of that work is happening now as I just kind of learn the environment and meet all the players.
And what's your first impressions?
Oh, I love it. You know, I think it's, as I noticed from the first time I was up here, not only is it a beautiful place, but I think the people are terrific. And in my travels so far around the state, I have found people who are genuinely committed to creating a healthcare system that works for everyone here. And I think that's a powerful thing. And if we can do it together, even better.
The way that I look at healthcare, and it may be different than the way you look at it, but there's three legs to a stool. There's mm-hmm. access, there's affordability, and there's quality. How do you think Vermont's doing in those three areas?
Well, I think it's doing certainly on quality. Vermont is right up at the top in terms of outcomes and the quality of healthcare that's available here in the state. In terms of cost, I think there's always opportunities to improve that, and that's part of moving to the all payer model, is to try to find where we can create better efficiencies and take costs out of the system. And then on access, you know, we have almost 100% insurance coverage in this state and hospitals that are there to serve communities throughout Vermont. So I think we're doing pretty well on all three, and there's always room for improvement.
One of the things I've been most surprised about, and I've written about this, I said we have, like you said, access out there in Vermont, and it seems to be almost universal in terms of access to quality. We seem to have quality health care. Affordability, we can discuss what's affordable and what's not affordable. But under access, the thing that I've been surprised about is are the calls that we're getting about complaints in two major areas. One is access to medical care. They may have insurance, but getting to see a primary care doctor, getting to see a specialist are some of the calls that we've been getting. And also, salaries of hospital administrators. Now, I only wanted to go on for about 15 minutes one day. We went on for 2 days on salaries of hospital administrators. Do you get the same complaints?
On the access issue, I mean, I should be clear that I've been here all of 7 weeks, so I haven't necessarily heard all of the issues around that. But I do think that promoting a primary care is hugely important, because that's how we make sure people don't get sick. And so to the extent that that there's not enough primary care and physicians to meet that need. We definitely need to work on that problem with partners. To your other issue around the salaries of healthcare executives, you know, Vermont is no different than anywhere else in terms of this issue. This is a tremendously complex business to run and manage, and the process by which the salaries are determined is done by boards of trustees who use benchmarks and examine and approve of these salaries to make sure they're getting the very best talent they can to manage a tremendously complicated organization.
I left out one, billing. Billing seems to be another issue where people feel it's way too complicated. Is there any movement in terms of the hospital association to make bills more understandable?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm not aware of any current initiatives, but I certainly am willing to look into that issue because I think it's hugely important that people understand their bills. And, you know, even the Affordable Care Act tried to make some progress on that in terms of there's, you know, not being too much fine print that's hard to read or hard to understand. So I think we've made advances in that, but I'm certainly, you know, willing to hear about those issues and try my best to make sure they're addressed as well.
We're speaking with Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Aaron in Montpelier. Aaron, you're on open mic with Jeff Thiemann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Welcome to Vermont.
Thank you.
So I've been following a little bit the all-payer waiver model and cost containment, and I'm just wondering, I know a lot of discussion about independent physicians in the state and how they operate and the differences that insurance companies will pay for exactly the same service to an independent facility, like an independent doctor, versus a hospital, and that hospitals can also charge facility fees. And that's really confusing, but when I think about it, it seems to me that the all-payer model, which is going to funnel money through and allow the state to make decisions about this, when so many decisions seem to be driven by like an increasing move towards a hospital-centric system, where do you see, you've talked about collaboration, where do you see independent physicians fitting into access, especially to primary care, and cost containment, because the cost of health insurance and health care are just so high?
Right. So I think in a place like Vermont, there are communities where if the independent physicians didn't become part of the hospital and sort of join the system, that they literally wouldn't be able to survive. And so the hospital then absorbs those physician practices by way of making sure that access continues to be available. As to the issue of the differences in reimbursement, you know, that really speaks to a different cost and regulatory structure that hospitals face even when they operate a physician's office on or off campus. And so those costs, you know, need to be figured into the equation. I think going forward that the all-payer model, again, is attempting to sort of make sure that all of the different players in the healthcare system are working together and trying to address the various issues, including the one you raise.
That was another issue we hear a lot about, that, you know, I was paying X amount of money to a doctor when they were an independent physician, and now that they belong to a health system, we're paying a lot more. Well, more. I don't know about a lot more, but it's more, and probably something you'll hear about as you go around the state.
Right, and you know, in that case, you know, what I would probably say to that person is that they want to make sure that their physician's office is a safe place that meets current regulatory standards, that provides the level of care they expect, and those are the kind of things that add costs into the system. But I do understand the frustration, and again, I think the all-payer model and other efforts on the parts of hospitals are always trying to address those issues and make sure that healthcare is affordable for consumers.
We're speaking with Jeff Thiemann, and he is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. When we come back, we'll speak about a couple of things dealing with Medicare reimbursement and also take more of your phone calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and in studio with me is Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont
Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And if you want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I've been concentrating on Jeff's vision. He's new to Vermont. He's new to the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. He's trying to get a sense of his vision, his organization, where he's heading it. The one thing that's happening out there right now is consolidation. You heard the caller talk about consolidation and the different prices dealing with consolidation. That seems to be a trend, not only in Vermont, but nationally. You look at Boston and all the consolidation that happened when you had, you know, Beth Israel is a separate hospital now, it's part of Deaconess, and Brigham and Women is now part of Mass General. It's just the way that it seems to be going. What does this mean to the consumer, consolidation?
You know, I think it speaks to a couple of the issues we've already talked a little bit about, one of them being cost, which is that in healthcare we can create economies of scale by joining with larger organizations in some cases, and being able to get better prices on supplies and those price differentials can then hopefully be passed on to the consumer. So part of it is about economies of scale, and part of it is about meeting community need and figuring out the best way to do that. And sometimes it involves hospitals aligning with physician practices, with ancillary care providers, with long-term care facilities, and doing so as a team so that care can be properly coordinated, which becomes easier sometimes in an environment where people are working more closely together.
How do we consolidate and not lose our community identity through our community hospitals?
Well, I think, you know, the community hospitals will continue to be there. And so I think a lot of the what you refer to as consolidation is actually invisible to the consumer, because they'll still be able to go to their community hospital, see the doctor that they're accustomed to seeing, get the care that they expect and the quality that they deserve. And I don't think that changes just because some of the financial models behind it are working to make sure that the hospital remains a vital resource to the community.
We're speaking with Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. If you have a question, comment, concern, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. There has, for a long time, been this complaint among hospitals and health systems of the state's level of Medicaid reimbursement. Is that a problem for hospitals and health systems?
It's a constant challenge. So I'll just step back one step here and talk a little bit about Medicaid. Medicaid, as you and your listeners probably know, is a critical program without which people who are low income and vulnerable, pregnant mothers, would not be able to receive the health care that they need. So Medicare provides a really important safety net. It also, both in Vermont and other states across the country, is not the best payer. It's underfunded, and that's a continual challenge both here in Vermont and elsewhere, and certainly one that is a top priority for the association and our members to make sure that Medicaid pays hospitals what they need to deliver quality care.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think the most important thing you do is tell stories. You tell legislators and regulators the vital importance of the program. You show them the people that it treats and serves, and you provide solid examples of what happens if that program is not only available but doesn't provide the kind of funding that hospitals really need to make sure that those patients are treated properly.
One of the things that's been going on here in Vermont, and if you're not, You probably are familiar with this one, but these sort of independent operations outside of a health system or a hospital, for example, same-day surgery, setting up a private same-day surgery unit outside of a hospital, is that something that concerns you and why?
It is something that concerns us because we want to make sure that the healthcare environment in Vermont is set up to meet the needs of its residents and not to build facilities that are superfluous or that needlessly compete with nearby hospitals. You know, a lot of times what happens with these facilities is that they draw away the most profitable patients from the hospitals and leave the ones that are the most expensive for the hospitals to care for. And meanwhile, don't necessarily provide some services like emergency care that may be really needed. You know, I think this also speaks to one of the other observations I've made about Vermont, which is that it's important to look at the motives of these organizations. And when I look at the hospitals in our state, they are all not-for-profit, which is a unique situation. I come from Washington, D.C., and I've worked in Illinois and Denver, and that's just not the case elsewhere. There are for-profit operators in other states. The mission of our hospitals here in Vermont is to care for people and improve the health status of communities. And I think that's a unique thing. And so when we look at whatever the issue is, billing or pricing or competing organizations or consolidation, it's really important to remember that hospitals come to the table, excuse me, wanting to do the best for their patients and wanting to serve their communities. That's what they exist to do. Their motives are really, they're not to serve shareholders, but to serve the community.
Senator Ash was here a few weeks ago, and he said the hospitals need to do a better job of knowing the cost of their services and procedures. Is this a problem?
Well, I think it's an issue nationwide that hospitals and all healthcare providers are always trying to understand their costs and find the best ways to contain them. Healthcare is an incredibly expensive and challenging enterprise to operate. Pharmaceutical costs are incredibly high, and that's something that hospitals are always managing. As we treat an aging population, there's a lot of costs associated with diabetes and other chronic conditions that are just hugely costly to manage. So I think we're always looking at where the costs are and trying to figure out where they can be taken out or significantly reduced. And that's an ongoing enterprise, and it probably will be for some time.
There's always discussion in the legislature, and whether it is a new governor, and there'll be discussion there about our healthcare system in general, particularly the way that we fund our healthcare system. Obviously, there was discussion about single payer, those sort of things. Is there a model out there, whether it's single payer or the model that we have now, is there a model that sort of meets the needs of hospitals and consumers?
I think the short answer to your question is no. I think that if you look at healthcare in the United States as a whole, and you compare it to other industrialized nations, you'll find that we pay more and get less than they do. And we have moved toward 100% coverage because of the Affordable Care Act, which is a feature that those other nations have. But I think here in Vermont, we have an opportunity to help create a model to show how it can be done. And I'm not saying that's going to be quick or easy, but I do think that there's an opportunity for us to move toward this quality-based system and show how we can both contain costs and improve patient satisfaction and then hopefully, ideally, be a model for the nation.
We're speaking with Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We got about 4 minutes to go, so what I'll do is, Tom, I'll take this phone call, and then I've got a couple more questions. We'll try to wrap it up in the 4 minutes. Let's go to Mary Ann in Randolph. Mary Ann, you're on open mic with Jeff Thiemann. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Well, my thing is, there's not enough primary care doctors, and if anyone does have a primary care doctor, it is hard to get in to see that doctor because they have so many patients. And I was wondering, why can't they pay the primary care doctors more money? Because they're the ones who keep people from becoming seriously ill and having to go and see these specialists. And then if they got more money, more people might, or more of the doctors wouldn't mind being in primary care because they get more from the specialists. And why isn't that some way of looking into something? Because then everybody could get to see their primary care doctor.
Right. Well, I couldn't agree with you more on the importance of primary care. And there definitely is a shortage of primary care physicians in Vermont. It can be difficult sometimes to recruit primary care physicians, as beautiful and wonderful as a place as this is to live. Sometimes it's hard for spouses to find jobs here, and there are other challenges related to recruitment. And so that can be one of the challenges that I think we need to look at different ways to solve. As for the way physicians are compensated, I mean, I agree. Primary care doctors should make enough money that they feel that their hard work to become a physician is properly rewarded. And that just speaks to the need to make sure payment works across the healthcare system. My job is to advocate for hospitals, but I believe everyone in the healthcare system who's involved in patient care needs to be properly paid. And so that is something that I'm certainly willing to work with partners on making sure we're always looking at. Primary care is vital.
Thank you, Jeff. That we've been speaking with Jeff Thiemann, President and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. He's new to his position, and I really appreciate him taking the time, after only 7 weeks on the job, giving us a preview of his vision of his organization. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network, an announcer for Motor Racing Network, but more importantly to all of you. He used to work here at WDEV and will be celebrating WDEV's 85th year anniversary with sort of going down memory road with Dave Moody. I think you'll all enjoy that. And just a preview for tomorrow coming up, Scott Milne, U.S. candidate for U.S. Senate. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. That's right, 85 years, WDEV News Radio celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. And I know you're busy sometimes, and you don't have time to listen into all of Open Mic. So go on to WDEVradio.com and click on the Open Mic podcast and listen to it anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. This is Mike Smith. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. On the line is Justin Duckham from D.C., live from D.C. And good morning, Justin.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Great to be with you. Does the debate look any different 2 days out than it did just after the debate?
You know, there's always time for that kind of digestion period, and I would say it does. You know, there's been a lot more attention just kind of paid to some of the more strange moments in that debate that may have kind of slipped by when we were all watching it just because, you know, sort of rapid fire and whatnot. But, you know, in particular, some more attention being paid to, you know, Donald Trump's claim when it comes to the cyber threat, as he put it. You know, his invocation of his 10-year-old son as a sign that computers are very easy to use has been getting some additional attention. And then, of course, we are you know, just getting some more fact-checking coming in. You know, there's a continuing debate over whether or not Trump supported the Iraq war. There's, you know, some continued scrutiny over what Donald Trump should do next time. You know, some look at how exactly the debate prep worked, and just kind of painting a pretty chaotic picture of what went into it. So it's, you know, something that is going to probably continue to dominate the discussion for the rest of the week. And, you know, obviously giving Donald Trump a lot of time to kind of tweak himself before going into the next one.
I asked this question to Luke yesterday, but I'd be curious about your answer. Will this debate make any difference?
I don't think it will to a large extent. You know, if it does make a difference, what we will see is essentially people who would have already been inclined to either candidate being energized. And I think when it comes to that, when it comes to appealing to your base, I think this was a you know, debate that Hillary Clinton just simply won due to the fact that she hit on all of her key points She went after her applause lines. Some of her zingers obviously didn't really go over very well, but in terms of what Democrats were looking for, she hit that pretty effectively. Trump, meanwhile, didn't really play up to his base. He didn't mention Benghazi, which would have been something that would have obviously been a nod to a lot of his supporters. He didn't mention the Clinton Foundation like he's been doing on the campaign trailer via his press releases for quite some time. Only went on one email attack against Hillary Clinton, one that got a huge applause line within the theater itself, which is a violation of the debate rules, but nevertheless occurred, and just left a lot of stuff on the table. So I think a lot of Trump supporters probably didn't hear what they were hoping for, probably expected him to take a stronger tone, especially with a lot of the more contentious issues. So I think in that sense alone, if we do see any shift in the polls, it's going to be because of Hillary Clinton motivating their base and not necessarily winning over people who would be inclined to Trump.
Justin, I got about 2.5 minutes, and I want to get to some other issues other than the debate. Government shutdown likely to happen or not?
It looks like they're going to be pushing it off. The new discussion going on right now is that they're going to pass a continuing resolution before Friday at midnight to fund the government through December 9th. That would take it beyond the election and put it in a lame duck section where the kind of political implications of it would be much more muted than it has been. The latest holdup is from Democrats who are opposing it for not having any language that would deal with the Flint, Michigan issue. They're pointing out that it's not fair considering that Louisiana funding is involved in there. They're trying to seek a ironclad agreement from the House right now, Democrat Republican leaderships and the leadership in the Senate, to guarantee that they will move down on with this at a later date. But so far, that continues to be one of the primary sticking points to getting a long-term CR issue before the election.
Justin, I'd be curious in your opinion, because in my opinion, the Democrats in Congress are not going to shut down the government over Flint, Michigan, are they?
It doesn't look likely. No, I think this is an opportunity for them where they have leverage and they are naturally going to push for items that they believe are important. I think, however, that the idea of a government shutdown in the middle of an election season, while it could play bad politically for one of the parties, probably is too risky to go for right now. So I think they probably are going to sign on to the temporary extension of funding until December 9th.
And finally, the veto override in the Senate today. The Senate and the House has sent legislation to President Obama, who vetoed it. That legislation would allow families of 9/11 victims to sue the Saudi government with their assets that are in the United States, to go after their assets in the United States. The Senate is poised to override that. Will that happen?
It looks like they are going to have the votes to do that. There needs to be a two-thirds majority in order to override a veto, and it looks like that is secure. There are some pushes right now from some leaders to try to prevent this from happening. Paul Ryan has said that he's opposed to it. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee is opposed to it. But it looks like this is something that just has overwhelming support across party lines and is probably going to land Obama the first time in his presidency that a veto has been overrode.
Justin Duckham from Talk Media News, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Justin Duckham, and we'll coming up, Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network. He'll be in studio. We'll be celebrating the WDEV 85th anniversary. Dave has been a part of the WDEV family, and we'll talk about some of the things that he did here at WDEV. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to have in our WDEV studios once again Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What we're doing is getting back sometimes the old gang and talking about WDEV.
Well, I guess, huh?
And the 85 years it's been on the air.
I wasn't here for all 85. I'm a relative newcomer in that regard, but I was here. I haunted these halls for a long, long time, and it's so neat to come back, and some of the same faces are still here, and the building is still pretty much what the building always was, and it's just had so many good years here, so many good times.
Let's sort of get back to our WDEV days, but first, I just wanted to since your days after you've left WDEV, what are you doing?
Well, I've relocated. I'm south in the Charlotte, North Carolina area now, making my living broadcasting NASCAR races. I kind of have two jobs that meld into one. Monday through Friday, I do 4 hours on Sirius XM satellite radio on their NASCAR channel. I do 3 to 7 in the afternoons. And then on weekends, I'm on the road covering the actual race events themselves. So most weeks, it's a 7-day week. My weeks off are 5-day weeks, you know. Oh, but it's been something that I've loved to do. You know, Ken kind of got me into the stock car racing thing a lot of years ago, and here I am still.
Let's talk about your background for a minute. How did you get into broadcasting? Were you always interested in broadcasting?
You know, I never really was. I think Ken decided that I was interested in broadcasting because, you know, I grew up at Thunder Road. I was a huge race fan for many years, worked on race cars for a while, and somehow transitioned into writing a column for the old New England Speedway Scene weekly trade paper. And I don't know if that's what doomed me or not, but at the point in time, late 70s, early 80s, where Ken started getting really busy with CBS and could not be on the microphone at Thunder Road every Thursday night, he started apparently looking around for somebody to replace him. And I don't know to this day how he set upon me. Maybe he read a couple of my columns and said, okay, you know, here's a kid with plenty of enthusiasm and a semi-workable vocabulary. Or maybe, you know, he just saw me standing off to the side with my finger in my nose and said, you know, here's a kid with time on his hands. I don't know. But over the course of time, beginning like the summer before my senior year in high school, he just started saying, okay, come up here and I'm going to teach you how to do this and I'm going to teach you how to do that. And after a while, he'd let me do maybe a street stock heat or something. And it just gravitated to the point where I was on the PA microphone for 30 years at Thunder Road before I moved south.
One of the things that I always find fascinating with people that are on radio is the fact that it does take a lot of preparation. People think you just show up, you get on the microphone, and right, you just talk away. What goes into your weekly preparation for a race?
Well, it varies. You know, to do the daily radio show, I'm on the air for 4 hours, and I'm doing at least that much a day in prep work. You have to read everything that's written. You know, you have to know, especially when you do like I do, we do talk radio where we take calls from race fans all over North America. And if you're not up to speed on something that's going on, you can guarantee that the first call of the day will be about that. And you're not going to know what you're talking about. You're going to sound like a trained monkey and nobody's going to listen to you anymore. So there's a lot of work involved doing the actual race events. It's not really any different than when I was on the PA microphone at Thunder Road. You have to be in the garage. You have to talk to the athletes. You have to talk to the crew chiefs. You have to find out, you know, who's mad at who and whose wife is at home in labor, you know, so they're distracted and not, you know, fully focused on the day. You have to know everything that's going on, whether it's Thursday nights at Thunder Road or Sunday afternoon at Daytona. It's really the same job.
We're speaking with Dave Moody, Motor Racing Network announcer. If you want to call in, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. What do you like most about your job?
Well, I love the sport, you know, and I went to my first race, ironically, at Thunder Road when I was like 6 years old. My uncle came over the mountain from Rumney, New Hampshire, was a huge Thunder Road fan, and eventually figured out he had a perfectly workable 6-year-old nephew just the next town over, so he dragged me to the racetrack. And I've ever since that first time at Thunder Road, I've never really been interested in anything else except racing. So I started out as a race fan. You know, the day they shovel dirt on my face, I'll die a race fan. I just love the sport. I love the people. You know, I love the stories, the human interest parts of it. You know, guys that go out there. Ken said decades ago, and it's as true today as it ever was, common men doing uncommon deeds. You know,
I've always wondered, as you start getting up to the higher level, and I don't want you to out anybody, but are there any drivers that are divas, or have most just retained their roots?
The vast majority have retained their roots. There are unbelievable demands on them for their time. I mean, you know, people think that, oh, they race on Sunday, but the other 6 days a week, they're pretty much to their own. They're not. There are, when you have multi-million dollar sponsors and you're responsible for paying hundreds, if not thousands, of mortgages every month, there's a lot of responsibility. It's like any other culture, any other subgroup of people, you know, doctors, lawyers, plumbers, whoever, you're going to have some guys that are just great and you're going to have some guys that are not so great. We're pretty lucky in our sport. Most of the guys, you know, at the upper levels of NASCAR remember where they came from and are very, very grateful for the opportunity that they have to do what they love to do and be paid pretty darn well to do it.
We've seen some retirements lately. We've seen some injuries. Dale Earnhardt Jr. has been injured with a concussion. We've seen Jeff Gordon retire. Will we see those superstars again in the sport, or are they right there right now?
That's the one thing that I don't worry about, because I've been around it long enough that I remember 20 or 25 years ago, Richard Petty and the Allison brothers and Buddy Baker and David Pearson and Cale Yarborough were all getting into the final, you know, the twilight, the final 3 or 4 years of their career. And I remember a lot of people being really concerned. What are we going to do when all the greatest stars of our sport all retire? Where it's the end of the line. And all of a sudden you looked around and Bill Elliott was here and Rusty Wallace was here and Tim Richmond was here and Jeff Gordon was here. And we've got the same thing now. We've got probably more great young talent in the feeder system, in the Xfinity Series and the Camping World Truck Series, who are all beginning. You know, the Chase Elliotts now are running full-time in Cup, and Ryan Blaney running full-time in Cup, and they're just so talented, and they're so young that I don't fear for the future of the sport.
We're speaking with Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network. We'll get to WDEV in a moment, because there's a lot of stories, I would imagine, about WDEV.
Oh, yes, a lot.
If you wish to join the conversation or you have a comment or question, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Joel and Barry. Joel, you're on Open Mic with Dave Moody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to comment that I miss Dave Moody's color with George Como for the Norwich University hockey team.
I miss doing it, Joel. I really do. Some of the most enjoyable times that I had in my many, many years here at WDEV was working alongside my good friend George Como, going on the road, calling national championship, you know, semifinal and final games for a tiny little school in the hills of Northfield, Vermont. Man, it was great, great fun, and I remember those days very fondly.
Well, your broadcast of those games got me interested in visiting Kreisberg Arena for the first game there. I ended up being a season ticket holder for like about 10 years.
I understand completely. You know, I miss a lot about being here in Vermont. You know, I miss being on top of Quarry Hill and Barry on Thursday nights, and I sure do miss being in Kreisberg Arena, sold out, you know, with a big important opponent for a key playoff game, and the roof just coming off that place. We had a lot of great times.
We're speaking with Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network, of course, an alumnus of WDEV, and we'll get to that in a minute. Dave, do you find the travel tedious? I mean, you're doing a lot of travel.
If I could just snap my fingers and instantly teleport to wherever I'm going and back again, I would do this forever. But yes, I love the game. I love the sport. I love the people I work with. Airports, rental cars, hotel rooms, not so much. If anything's going to wear you out in this job, it's the travel. Ken can tell you the same stories. It's like doing the job, it's almost like getting paid to be on vacation. You know, you're doing what you love, but the getting there and the getting back can be a little tedious.
I always remember when I was commuting, getting stuck in Philly all the time.
So. Yeah, Philadelphia Airport is a trial. And you know, when I lived here in Vermont, I was on 4 airplanes a week to get anywhere I was going. One of the major reasons for me to locate down to North Carolina was I've cut the number of airplanes I'm on in a year by more than 50%. And yeah, I don't get stranded in Philly anymore.
What are some of the challenges of NASCAR in the future?
Well, you know, obviously it's like any major league sport, and it costs a lot of money to play. At the highest level of our sport, it's no longer a $1 million deal. It's not even a tens of millions dollar deal. It's a hundreds of million dollar deal. And there are far fewer billionaires out there than there are millionaires. And when you get up to that area where you almost have to be a billionaire to play anymore, there are fewer people that are willing to play. You know, NASCAR wrestles with that every day. How to keep the cost as reasonable as possible. Now, you can't own a Major League Baseball team unless you're a billionaire, or an NFL team unless you're a billionaire. And I guess it probably makes sense you can't own a NASCAR team unless you're a billionaire. But we need to, and I think they understand, we need to keep it so at the worst you have to be a billionaire and not a 100 billionaire, because there are even fewer of those out there.
We're speaking with Dave Moody of Motor Racing Network. We'll return and talk specifically about WDEV and Dave's days here. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, Dave, your days at WDEV. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Now turning back to Dave Moody of Motor Racing Network. Dave, let's talk about WDEV. What did you do here at the station?
Well, that's a long question to answer because, as you know, in small market radio, sometimes you do what needs doing. My official title was sports director for WDEV, for WLVB. Chief play-by-play announcer. You know, in the winter months, we'd do most years between 90 and 125 high school basketball and hockey games a year, just depending on how well the local teams did. If they went all the way to the state championships, we went all the way with them. I sold a little advertising. I did whatever needed doing as far as the sports deal was concerned. Worked for many years, you know, out doing play-by-play with my dear friend, the late Mal Bowright. He was my color man for a lot of years, and we just had great times together. For a lot of years, I was, one-man band, where you show up at the gymnasium and you set up the equipment. You're the engineer. You set up the equipment. You get the lineups. You do the coach's interview. You call the play-by-play. You do the pregame, the postgame, the halftime show. You did it all. And, you know, we already talked about doing Norwich hockey with George, which was just such a great treat. We did some really goofy stuff over the years, too. I mean, we did, for a number of years, probably 4 or 5 years, we covered live and on the air the Vermont State Snowplow and Backhoe Championships from the Barry Auditorium. It's like, boy, it's a big day for the town of Topsom. They came from behind in the backhoe competition, and they've taken the lead over East Corinth. And just crazy stuff that nobody else would have ever thought to do. But, man, Ken thought it was important, so that off we'd go. If anybody that ever tried to do play-by-play on a backhoe, it was an interesting life, an interesting job.
You deserve to be at NASCAR, then.
I guess. You learn to do everything. You hang around here long enough, you learn to do everything.
Is there something about WDEV that brings a smile to your face? Some event or something that you did that made...
Well, the weirdest one was the one we just talked about. But, you know, the main part that just... When I think of WDEV, it's a couple of things. And first and foremost, obviously, is the people. That we were I was so blessed to work with over the years, you know, Jack Donovan and Tom Beardsley and Brian Harwood, you know, and going back, even Cousin Harold and Mike Carey, just wonderful, wonderful people who were here for decades. You know, Jack and Mike and Beards, they were here when I arrived, and they were here long after I left, and they were just such an ingrained part of this community and of their listening audience. And to me, you know, that came from the top down. Ken always preached, be in touch with your listeners, serve your community. And, you know, you and I were talking a little bit during the break a few minutes ago. I live down in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, and we've had some violent nights down there recently. And a couple of the local TV stations that preach and preach and preach and bang the drum about being in touch with their community and serving their viewers and, you know, local small town news team, you know, they're tearing the city of Charlotte apart at 8 o'clock in the evening, and they're showing Modern Family and Dr. Phil, and they don't even go on the air to let you know that these riots are breaking out until they're regularly scheduled 11 o'clock news. And I sat back and I shook my head and I said, man, Ken Squire and Eric Michaels wouldn't be doing it this way. They'd be out in the streets covering the unrest in their community and telling people what was happening.
We're speaking with Dave Moody of Motor Racing Network. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm getting questions from downstairs, so let's ask that question. the great Zamboni breakdown story.
Oh Lord, yeah, we were at Kreuzberg Arena in Northfield, where Norwich plays. Very early on in the tenure of the building, I don't remember if it was their grand opening, but it was a big night. It was a playoff game or something huge. And George and I are on the air doing the pre-race show. And the Zamboni is out resurfacing the ice. And just as it comes over the big Norwich University logo at center ice, this horrifying noise comes out from under the Zamboni. And it proceeds to empty every ounce of motor oil and antifreeze that the engine contained on the ice at Kreuzberg Arena. It took forever to clean it up, and Como and I tap danced, and we sang, and we did crossword puzzles on the we interviewed everybody but the janitor waiting for them to get that all cleaned up. That was a heck of a night. I'd forgotten about that.
What about the baseball rainout parade?
Oh, no, that was basketball.
Basketball. I'm sorry.
We had a halftime parade in a basketball game, a high school basketball game. It was a Saturday afternoon. And we were playing at People's Academy in Morrisville. And it was one of those deals where we were just reaching the end of winter. And it was one of those weird days where it got warm and it rained and it rained and it rained. And unfortunately, there was, you know, ice buildup on all of the roofs. And about 4 minutes left in the second quarter, People's Academy against Lamoille Union, all of a sudden, drip, drip, drip at center court. The water starts coming down through the roof. And the drip, drip, drip turned into, well, not quite a gusher, but it was a heck of a lot more than they possibly could have played around. So with about 4 minutes left in the first half, the referees blew the whistle, said, we can't play anymore. The athletic directors got their heads together and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to load everybody up, and in about 20 minutes, we're going to haul it across town to Lamoille Union, and we're going to play the second half at Lamoille. So I made the explanation, tore the equipment down. Everybody packed up their basketballs, put their coats on. We jumped in the car. Probably 500 cars in a convoy went from People's Academy to Lamoille Union, plugged the equipment back in, played the second half. It's the only high school basketball game in history with a halftime parade.
We're speaking with Dave Moody, of course, who is a WDEV alum. Also, now with Motor Racing Network, if you wish to join the conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. What's your proudest moment here?
It wasn't a sporting deal. And it goes back to, you know, when you work in small market radio, especially when you work for WDEV and Ken Squire and Eric Michaels, when things happened, you know, when... I don't even remember the year now, but basically the city of Montpelier flooded. And that was my hometown. And this was back just at the advent of cell phones. I don't think there were 15 cell phones in all of Vermont at that time. And we received word that the city of Montpelier was flooding. And there was no question in anybody's mind how we were going to react. We headed out. And I remember very clearly standing in knee-deep water on one of the corners of State Street in Montpelier, watching the water rise and slowly but surely flood all of the downtown businesses. I did play-by-play from a phone booth as the ice picked up a railroad bridge in Montpelier, spun it around 180 degrees, and dropped it into the river. And, you know, Anson Tebbets was part of the staff back then. He was on one end of town doing updates. You know, Nadine Martin was on the other end of town doing updates. You know, I was the youngest guy at the time. Sorry, Nadine. Sorry, Anson. But I was the one walking through town on, in knee-deep, icy, cold water, still calling people. I didn't realize that talking on a hardwired telephone, you know, from a phone booth, which we still had back then, probably wasn't the great idea in the middle of a flood. I figured, okay, I'm just calling in. But in vintage WDEV fashion, we were on the air from the start. We stayed on the air all night long. One of the competitors, who will remain nameless, you know, one of the stations in the area, they had their studios, their home studios on Main Street in Montpelier on the second floor. And the extent of their coverage was at the end of a record saying, they tell us there's a flood here in Montpelier and we have to go off the air. Goodbye. And meanwhile, we'd been on the ground for an hour and a half covering the flooding and talking to people and telling parents how to get into town the back way to pick their children up from school because the buses couldn't get out of the city. That to me was what it was all about. You know, small market radio serving the community.
When we come back, more about WDEV with Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network, but also he's been around here for a few years at WDEV as well. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Dave Moody, who's here in studio with us from Motor Racing Network, but also is an alum of WDEV, and we're celebrating the 85th year anniversary of WDEV. Dave, why is this station so beloved in Vermont?
Well, I think, Mike, it's because in a certain way, it hasn't changed. You know, back in the day, every radio station was a hometown radio station, and you had live people on the air. You had personalities that people could identify with, that people knew, that were part of their community, that were members of their community. And over time, a lot of radio, most of radio, devolved, in my opinion, into, well, first it devolved into which box of records are we going to play? And then it devolved into which satellite are we going to pull our box of records off of? And there aren't any live people at the radio station anymore. You know, when the hurricane hits or the capital city floods or the train derails, no one knows because they're just pulling their music down off the satellite. There's nobody there to tell me what's happening in my community. And WDEV's never been that. And there, you know, it would have been easy over the years for Ken to just say, okay, we'll put in a machine and we'll pull some records down off the satellite and we'll let somebody else handle all of this. And he's never been willing to do it. You know, you're here doing what you're doing. There aren't shows like this anymore. There's not programming like this anymore. There's 99.9% of the radio stations in the country don't let their listeners call in and say what they think or how they feel. You know, they don't let them talk about how they're mad at the governor or thrilled with the governor. You know, and just WDEV is a blast from the past. It stayed topical, it stayed relevant, it stayed important, and it stayed tied to its community. It's not just a box of records.
We're speaking with Dave Moody, obviously a longtime employee here at WDEV, but now works for Motor Racing Network. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment directed to Dave at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on Open Mic with Dave Moody.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning to you, Dave.
Morning, Paul.
Hey, Dave, I've been listening for years, and as a fellow Montpelier graduate, you're a class behind you, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I take pride in the accomplishments of my fellow classmates, including those in your class. My brother in particular, who was a U.S. Olympic track and field coach, and you with your accomplishments and many, many others. And I find it amazing, coming from small town Vermont, the ability of some to take it onto a larger stage. And I'm trying to impart some lessons to my daughter, who's growing up here in Vermont. Have you got anything in particular you can talk about that would maybe help in terms of making some of the younger kids understand that just because we're in a small town, a small state, that does not prevent you from moving on to bigger things? And you can, you know, what type of values do you take with you that's helped you as you've moved on?
Well, first of all, thank you, Paul. It's good to hear from you. I know exactly who you are. The minute you talked about your brother, and say hello to him for me as well. Yeah, starting out in a small town is not a disadvantage. It's an advantage in many, many ways because you're connected to your community and you have that support system. You know, you have that "it takes a village" thing going on still here in Vermont. And find your passion. You know, if you're preaching to your daughter, and I know preaching to your children sometimes doesn't work very well because you're dad, you know, and they'll listen to others where they won't listen to you. But find your passion. Find something that you're interested in. Find something. You know, the old saying is true that if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And that's the key to it to me. A, find something that you're passionate about, and B, work hard at it. And you know, I have people ask me all the time, how do I get started in doing what you do? How do I get to be, you know, how do I get to do what you do someday? And I say, well, you start out by being willing to work for free at your local racetrack for a couple of years. 90% of them say, oh, I'm not going to work for free. Well, then you're not going to get anywhere, because that's how you start. A lot of people think you start climbing the ladder on the 10th or 11th rung. You don't. You start at the bottom, and you climb slowly, and it may take you 20 years to get to the top.
Let's go to a call from Williston. You're on open mic.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Dave, pleasure listening to you over the years, sports, and especially up at Thunder Road. My question for you is, one of your key phrases up there when the guys are getting ready to put the hammer back down is, "Grandma, put your teeth in your pocketbook." I'm just wondering if you've tried that in any NASCAR races.
I think I did one time many years ago, but I want to be clear about that. I stole that from Squire. Squire said that 25 years before I ever said it, and when I took over for him at Thunder Road, you know, it was just so fitting that, you know, when things are really getting set to break out with five laps to go, "Grandma, put your teeth in your pocketbook. This one's going to get hairy." And I have no qualms about having stolen that from Kenley. I'm proud to have stolen it from Kenley, and it, you know, Ken had a way of turning a phrase.
Just think of the emails you'd get if you said that nationally now.
Yeah, it's probably right. That would be probably not as political. Correct as we need to be now.
Another caller calling in. You're on with Dave Moody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Question. Back early, I think it's 1990, I guess. Is that when Loudon started for NASCAR?
Loudon starting in...
Yeah, early 90s when they got on the Cup schedule, for sure, yeah.
Okay, I had tickets from 92 up through to about 2 years ago. And question, why are they getting less people in the stands now? Is it the economy? Because I know it's not the tickets.
Yeah.
You can buy tickets, you know, now on charge and stuff like that, where we used to have to have the money up front to buy tickets.
It's not just a NASCAR problem. Major League Baseball, you know, the NFL even is having problems in a lot of their markets. The National Hockey League, the NBA, movie theaters are struggling. Broadway is struggling. There's a couple of different things. Obviously, the economy's in kind of rough shape still. People don't have the discretionary income that they used to have. And honestly, there's a lot more competition out there. When I grew up here in Vermont, we had three channels to watch, and if the president was on, you didn't have anything. It was him or nothing. Now there are 1,000 TV channels. There's the internet. There's a lot of things that people can do rather than spend their money and invest the time that it takes to go to a NASCAR race.
So where do you head off next?
Well, I'm going home on Monday. We'll be in Charlotte next weekend, or we'll be in Dover next weekend. I have that weekend off. Then we'll be on to Charlotte, and then, you know, I'll be back on a bender of about 35 or 40 straight days of work before we get to Homestead Miami Speedway in November.
And what happens during the off season?
Well, my off season isn't really all that off. I'm not on the road on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday because there's no racing to go to, but I'm still doing 4 hours a day on the radio. So yeah, my off season, I cut back from 7 days a week down to five.
Let me ask you this, turning to NASCAR. You know, I find the throwback events at Darlington great. I love those events. How do fans respond?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's really turning, and this year was the second year that they've done it. It's turned into one of the most favorite things, one of the most popular things on the circuit. The fans now are turning, you know, the teams come out with the throwback paint schemes. They're coming out in throwback uniforms now. Fans are coming out. I mean, we had fans coming out in bell-bottom jeans and love beads and you know, frilly-fronted shirts. It's really awesome. It's once a year, and as long as they keep it once a year, it'll be special.
One of the things that is going on right now is the Chase. Who would you describe as the favorite this year?
Boy, it's really hard to say. I mean, there are two guys that have, you know, already locked themselves into going on to the next round of the playoffs, and that's Martin Truex Jr. and Kevin Harvick. Both of them are easily capable of winning this thing when it's all said and done. You know, but the really fascinating part about this Chase format is that if you have a bad day in any one of these three race rounds, if you have a bad day, your back is to the wall, and you effectively have to win one of the next two races in order to advance. A year ago, we saw Jimmy Johnson eliminated in the opening round. It doesn't look right now like any of the quote-unquote favorites are in danger of not advancing. Tony Stewart is in danger, but, you know, nobody really saw him as a championship favorite this year. But The fun part of this deal is that every race could be an elimination race if you have a bad day.
If you could do any other race, motorsports race, other than NASCAR, what would it be?
Indy 500. Yeah, that's just such a spectacle. It's getting back to the point where it's actually a good race again now after a few years of being not so much. But to go there, you know, I've been at Indy on for NASCAR races, but to go there and to see what they do on Memorial Day weekend for over 100 years now, that would be a special thing to do.
Any F1 interest?
You know, F1 really doesn't push my button all that much. There's too much technology and not enough driver there. And don't misunderstand, I have great respect for the guys that drive those cars. But if you can adjust your race car from pit road by pushing a button without ever coming to the pits, that doesn't capture my fancy. And, you know, 99% of the passing happens on pit road. It doesn't happen on the racetrack. I like a good old stock car race where you can get your knuckles bloodied and knock a guy out of the way and maybe make an enemy before it's over.
Dave Moody, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
This has been great. I want to thank our guests, Jeff Thiemann, who is the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Also, Talk Media News, and, of course, Dave Moody, who's sitting right across from me right now from Motor Racing Network. Tomorrow, U.S. Senate candidate, Republican Senate candidate, Scott Milne. This is Open Mic. And you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio. The Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future. Look, you can go on our WDEVradio.com website and click on to the Open Mic podcast anytime and listen to it at your convenience. I know you can't listen to it all the time, but live here, and of course we had a great show with Dave Moody, but you can go on our WDEVradio.com website and listen to us anytime. So, WDEV, we're broadcasting. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, as I just mentioned, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Make sure you pick up the Open Mic podcast on any show that you like. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.